We are at the end of a semester of background material. This is Old Testament redemption. Remember, the topic of this thought, of this whole series, is about what happened at the cross, which is a New Testament event, clearly, right? But we have been trying to understand in our civilization, in our time, what those words meant, what those religious words in the New Testament were, and what shock value they would have had for first century hearers. So when John the Baptist gets up there and says, "Behold, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world," does it just rolls like water off a duck's back sometimes. But the people in the time of the day, you know, people of those times, there would have been a shock value associated with that we studied last year. They would have thought of these things, and it would have hit the head, just cracked their fiberglass for a few minutes maybe. And in redemption in the Old Testament, we're now, like I say, in what that word meant in the Old Testament, what redeemed meant. And we consistently keep coming back that it meant rescue plus effort or cost or price or something of this type. So it was more than just rescue. A lot of times it wasn't clear what the cost was, what the price was, what all was involved with that. And we won't see that. We'll see that in the New Testament. We'll see that in the New Testament. Now, what we're going to look at today, though, is the background. We're going to try to summarize what we looked at for several months. So, if you have a syllabus, I don't think they passed out the others, but we're on page 9 of 9, and the first one is that the concept of redemption, and I'm going to use that word, but remember redemption was rescue at the payment of a price or some effort or cost. The concept of redemption was rooted in A, legal practice, and B, the Exodus. The average Israelite would have been repeatedly reminded of this in daily economic life, in the marketplace, at the Safeway, at the Lucky, at the whatever, okay? Would have been reminded of this in daily economic and religious life. And this familiarity shows up in the spiritual lives of the psalmist as they call upon God to redeem them from the situations they find themselves in. Now, what that basically meant is that To the Israelite, that if we did a word association quiz and they were on TV, and I said, say the first thing that pops into your mind, and I had two Israelites, and I said redemption, the richer of the two would say the Exodus, the poorer of the two would say servitude or slavery, being brought out of slavery, because they may be there or going there or headed there or worried about that at home, right? And those are the two things, this big one. And the Exodus was this big redemption. But there were constant little redemptions that the Israelites went through. Sometimes they were the economic ones where they bought back a sacrificial animal. They bought it back. Or they went and bought their older brother Glenn out of servitude. Okay? As we've talked about repeatedly. Then there were those times that we say, help. The redemption song. Help. Rescue, O Lord. Kind of thing. Right? And so they had this experience, this gigantic redemption experience, being snatched from the jaws of Pharaoh, that defined who they were, but did not guarantee them protection from future troubles. After the big redemption, there were countless little bitty redemptions. Countless little bitty redemptions. In the lives of the holiest to the least holy among them. There were constant situations in life that required us to depend upon our brothers, and our God. Okay? Same thing is true in the New Testament. If you can remember when Jesus washed the feet. Remember the last night before the arrest, right? When he put on the servant's garments and washed the feet of the disciples to give them a role model, to show them what God was like. To show them what God was like. He's not a God of arrogance. He's a God in pursuit of somebody else's welfare. So this Jesus put on the garment of the foot washing slave and went around to the apostles, you know, the various disciples there, and washed their feet. When he got to Peter, remember, Peter was not going to let this happen. Peter had his own views of religion, his own views of what Messiah should be like. Remember, he had had a running argument with Jesus all through Jesus' ministry as to what the Messiah would be like. No, you're not going to die. Don't talk to the troops about you dying in Jerusalem to destroy morale. No. We got to spin doctor this thing. You know, we're not going to do this, you know. And when he came and said, "You'll never wash my feet," Jesus says, "If I don't wash you, you have no part with me. You have no part with me." It's an iterative process. And Peter, in his impetuous nature, said, "Well, then don't just wash my feet. Wash all of me. I want the big bath." And then Jesus says, no. And there are two different words for clean and bathe in this passage, nipto and lavo. And Jesus then uses a phrase where he says, no, he that has a big bath word, okay, doesn't need that, but all they need are the little baths. In other words, saints, when they walk around, they get their feet dirty. And they still need cleansing. They still need to go and ask for help. They still need to ask for, "I've got myself into trouble again here, God, and I need a little redemption. Can I have a little redemption? You've done the big one, and now I'm part of your family and part of your community." And so the Israelite, this was ground in. They understood. It didn't matter. I was telling somebody that took, this past week, who took stress medication, anti-stress medication. But it was medication that takes 3 days before it starts working. And so, you know, it's one of those kind of things. It's a problem. So I told this person, I said, "Well, what you need to do is when everything is working well, start your medication, because you know life is like that. This is the way it works. You can be sure that you're going to need it in about 3 days if everything's going well." And this is the way the life of humans are. Humans are. And so the psalmist would have a psalm about, "I'm on top of the world. I'm surrounded with songs of deliverance," right? And then the next psalm would be the complete opposite. "How did I get here? That's where I was yesterday. Yesterday's journal was way up on Zion. This one, I'm in the pit of Sheol. I'm in the pit of Sheol." So their concept of redemption, they saw it all the time. It was always there. They always saw this notion of redemption, buying out, changing status, returning home, things of this type. Second point, redemption could be experienced by individuals and by groups. Example, the nation. Okay. Now, the Israelite redemption of the Exodus was a group redemption. He redeemed the nation Israel because he chose their forefathers. Remember, he had a covenant with Abraham, right? Then his descendants, one group of his descendants, were the subject of this covenant and this national redemption. You could be the worst Israelite or the best Israelite, and you still got out of Egypt. You still got out of Egypt, as long as you went with them. Okay? And it didn't matter your status. When you got into the land or during the wilderness wanderings, there were lots of individual redemptions. I didn't have to have the problem of going up to God and saying, "Well, just by me myself, I know I don't count, God. I'm only part of the body of Christ. I'm just lost, a faceless one in this community thing, and that's only your interest is in corporate salvation or corporate entities or something of this type. And so I'm just a faceless number. You know, another little person in this group." But there's an individual element as well as a corporate element. It is not strictly individualistic either. In Western civilization, we don't have the notion of extreme corporate solidarity. In the Semitic world, in the Old Testament, one person could represent the entire nation. When a king or a prophetic figure could be addressed by God, God could call them Israel. And they would represent the king, bore the high priest, remember, it's a good thing, because remember, the high priest would carry the sins of the nation, remember, in on the Day of Atonement. So we are fortunate in that there's this thing called corporate solidarity, together as one. This is how one person can die for the sins of the whole world, that one can represent a representative status of this type. Yeah.
How would this tie in with universalism and current thinking among
Well, that's a tremendously long subject, but at a surface level, it has to do that there are many different groups. In other words, I can leave Israel, for example, the Old Testament. I could decide that I don't want to be an Israelite anymore. I can, and we had lots of that occurring between the Testaments, where they would go through ceremonies and become Greeks as opposed to Jews. So there were... The corporate solidarity boundary is one I could leave. I could divorce my kin. I could be disinherited by my father. I mean, so the boundaries were not fixed, rigid things. But there was always the interaction, the individual interaction of getting in and out. If I was an Egyptian, I could become an Israelite before God, basically. So he does do it within the corporate circles, but the corporate circles or the boundaries are not as fixed from the standpoint of Scripture. So you can get in and out of those. And a lot of these corporate solidarity things are images and pictures anyway, so you have to be careful with how far you define the boundaries. Good question, though. The point here is that the Israelite would understand, could appeal to God, redeem our nation, but could also turn around and redeem me from other people in the nation. Remember those evil people that went along the wall? Remember we talked about any number of these people that were members and ruling class of Israel, right? That became oppressive and arrogant and powerful and exploitative, and that even the king had to fear from these individuals. Political treachery, treason, things of this type. So I can recognize that God is interested in redeeming, rescuing us as a community, and that we all play our part in that. And I can also recognize in the fullest sense that I still have an individually special relationship with God as well. I'm just not another drop in an ocean, but I'm not an ocean in myself. I really do belong in a family and community that God cares about rescuing. And He delivered the nation any number of times, and in the process delivered people that might not have otherwise have been redeemed. In other words, when he stops Sennacherib from taking Jerusalem, how many righteous Israelites would there have been in Jerusalem on a percentage basis? The answer would it have been 100%? Probably not. Not likely is a better way of putting it. I was putting it more kindly. Probably not. But not likely is an even stronger statement, and definitely not would be closer to the truth. Matter of fact, we would be lucky to find 10 righteous, perhaps, if we had that. But we have that scenario where He will do these corporate things, and He also still had an individual element. We had this in the Old Testament. 3, sometime the adversity that we needed to be rescued from was deserved and just. In other words, we got ourselves in trouble. A crime, sin, exile. We got ourselves into that. And it was through bad choices, deliberate bad choices in some cases, but it was our fault, literally. And we said, sometimes, can you redeem me from that? You're right, I'm wrong. And can you rescue me from that? And sometimes it was not. Sometimes it was misfortune, oppression, or being in the wrong place. Remember when we would have those audience participation, and I'd say, what did they do to get in trouble? Half the cases we had was nothing. They were just in the right place walking with God. And they got attacked, oppressed, something of this type. So it didn't have a lot to do with all adversity, but sometimes the adversity was deserved. Sometimes we got ourselves in trouble, and sometimes we didn't. The same thing was true with the Israelites. 4, is it always involved subjugation to an undesired faith, and it was often abusive faith. Not always, but it was often abusive. I just didn't want to be there. In other words, if I got, in financial trouble, I had to sell myself over to some other tribe to do labor for 7 years. This was not a sabbatical. This was a more abusive scenario, and one that I didn't want to be. I wanted to be home with my family celebrating Hanukkah. I didn't want to be over here working and doing these things and being displaced. Okay, I wanted to be growing my family and things of this type. And so it was an undesired fate. That may not have been an abusive fate, because that was, God said, absolutely, you will not abuse this individual. I hate this. Remember where you came from, etc. Okay, but in the cases of prisoners of war, being captured, and things of this type, it was abusive. Being slaves in Egypt, it was an abusive situation. So we're talking here about abusive relationships are certainly undesirable states that the Israelite would have said, redemption is from something bad. Redemption means rescuing from something I don't want. Something I don't want. 5, was it required a kinsman with more than adequate resources, with will and commitment to you? They didn't have to do it, remember. In other words, it wasn't required, absolutely, of your kinsman to go redeem you. In the case of my brother Bill or my brother Chris, if I had alienated them in some way in the process of getting myself in a bad situation and I sold myself over here into servitude, they didn't have to come get me, you know, at all. It wasn't required. It took, redemption required somebody that cared enough and would invest the resources and made a commitment to you to go do it. And they had to make a decision to do it. They would have the authority. I remember one of the lessons I learned as a junior executive growing up through executive ranks was the concept of management will. That the CEO, even though you were a favored person to the CEO, and they had the power to support you, it didn't mean that they often did. They wouldn't meddle with their senior execs below them and upset the power balance always, right? Just to support somebody that they favored. It took they would go out on a risk to play a favorite that would upset political dynamics in the senior executive team. And I learned this, and this was what was called management will. And now management will means basically you have teeth on it, that you pursue it, that you heat-seeking missile, whatever it is you're after. And what's required is here, is this, is, and that's what it took on the part of a rescuer, of a redeemer, had to have will to go do this and see it to its course. Because the adversary might fight back. The adversary might fight back. The adversary may be a war machine that's built to fight back. It might be a legally skillful, powerful person in Israel at the courts that would fight back. Okay? There would be any number of personal risk, and it took management will to do that. Point six was that the payment to redeem you was sometimes greater than the value of what was being redeemed. In the case of sacrificial animals, if I had to sacrifice one of the clean or unclean animals as part of a religious ritual, if I wanted to buy that back, I had to pay a premium on top of that. I had about a 20% redemption overage or fee, whatever you'd call that, an ROF or whatever. And after I'd filled out the little scroll form, I could do it, but I'd have to pay that overage. And so redemption sometimes was more costly than what the subject was worth. Okay. Now, you'll have to figure out where we're going with this in the New Testament, by the way. But you can see some of the basic shapes forming here, okay? But there are some big surprises by the time we get to the New Testament, by the way. So I just want to tease you with that. The payment was sometimes greater than the value of what was being redeemed, okay? Seven, redemption is the area from which the concept of resurrection of the righteous arises. Redemption from the grave. Now, most of the redemptions that we saw in the Old Testament had to do with from earthly foes and earthly problems and people chasing, Saul chasing David, you know, and the Egyptians, you know, enslaving and brutalizing the Israelites. And most of those were sort of earthly kinds of things. If you remember, as we saw historically, it got worse. Toward the end, they started asking questions about redemption from the grave, from the power. Anything powerful that was oppressive was a possible subject of redemption. And one of it was redemption from the grave. See? And to the ancient Israelite, being redeemed from the grave meant a resurrection. Not just a life in some ethereal heavenly spot in my soul or spirit. You know, they got a full body back out of this deal. Right? Then the dead of the earth shall rise. They will come up out of the dust. And they were back in their full states. Okay? And so when we get, by the way, redemption in the New Testament, a lot of it will have to do with these things, little mud balls with hair and teeth. Okay, getting some new version of those back with perhaps more hair and more teeth for some of us. Okay, and so redemption will have this care, but redemption has this element since it involves, for the Israelite and prophecy, the body. It is one of the last things that occurs in God's timetable. See? The stuff that's going on right now, we participate in redemption's rescue daily. Every day His compassions are new, and the transforming work that He does because of the new covenant in our lives is equated to the power of the resurrection of Christ. So those of us that don't look like a lot of work is happening on us, okay, that there's still a fire that's inside that's transforming me from the inside out at the same level of difficulty, perhaps even greater, than that associated with the resurrection of a dead person. Okay? The resurrection to a spiritual body, to a new body, that kind of stuff. That power is still present, but because redemption in the New Testament, when we see it, will have a lot to do with the body, which means it'll be a little later in God's timetable than the stuff He's doing now. Okay? But that's where we get resurrection concepts come from, redemption image. Eight, in the sacrifice image, the offerer brought a sacrifice which cost something. In redemption, the rescuer invests personal resources and effort, which costs something, to secure the release of the redeemed. So remember when we studied sacrifice, part of the whole point of sacrifice was that I brought something as a statement of goodwill and a recognition that my breach of conduct did damage. and I'm trying to make amends. I'm trying to make reparations. And so I would bring something that was valuable to me to give to the person that I had offended, basically as a statement of goodwill. It could never repair the damage in most cases. Okay, but it cost something to me. David said, "I will never sacrifice a burnt offering to the Lord that did not cost me. That cost me nothing, basically. I would not do that. It has to be something dear to me." When we got to the New Testament, we saw that us offering a sacrifice to God to repair that relationship, there was no way we were going to be able to do this. So who ended up doing this? God did this. That was the point of the cross, right? Is that He was His own sacrifice, so that we got off free, okay, by grace. And in the case of redemption, this is a situation where the Redeemer, I would go, if you were in trouble, I would go rescue you by investing something. In the case of money, if it was like the servant situation, I paid for your labor. In other words, my money was a substitute for your work for 6 years or 7 years or whatever it was, or the remainder of that term. So that the payment price, although it's not fully here in the Old Testament, was the substitute, see, for what was being redeemed. Something took its place, basically, in terms of economic value. 9 is redemption from oppressors often involved judgment and what I would call kinsman outrage. And we talked about the kinsman redeemer. Remember, the kinsman redeemer would right wrongs. And one of the fundamental things that we did not talk about that I should have probably mentioned about this, because we had the notion that if you killed me accidentally and I die, then my brother is going to come after you, right? Under Israelite law, that's the way the legal system worked. He would be called the avenger of blood, and his job was to right that wrong if there was indeed a wrong. But because accidents could occur, there had to be protection from this person that accidentally did this, right? He weren't prosecuted for manslaughter at the same level like we do today. Okay? The kinsman is going to take your life. Now, is that going to restore your life at all? No. So how does that rescue you? See, at some level it doesn't rescue from death. What it rescues is from the community of your reputation. See, in the old Deuteronomy, in the laws, is that I die an early, premature death if I'm wicked. I get put to death, but God will use people to strike me down if I'm wicked. So if I die accidentally before my prime out there in Israel, the assumption is I am wicked, right? My name is fouled. My reputation and my family is, with the trickle down associated with uncleanness in Israel and marginalization and things of this type. In the case of a legal thing, when it's clear to Israel that the murderer was killed, then I am exonerated as the victim. I did not die. I died at the hands of the wicked, not because I was wicked. And my name is restored in Israel. My family is restored to its rightful place in the community of worshipers. And I'm not looked at funny when I come to church. You know, that whole community dynamic was part of what righting this wrong was about. That's how a redemption of the name, basically a redemption of the reputation, a restoration from scandal within Israel. Because scandal had tremendous implications in Israel in terms of worship. So the kinsman, this required sometimes redemption from oppressors involved judgment on them and kinsman outrage. 10, by the close of the Old Testament, Israel knew that her enemies included herself. Remember, we talked about early that Israel was fighting, Egypt and Assyria and things of this type. But by the time you get to the close of the Old Testament, they start realizing that they are the problem, that there's something inside them that stops them from doing good. Now, I brought a quote that's from the spring syllabus. I've got about a third of the spring syllabus done, and I brought a quote from it that I'm just going to read you ahead of time, and because it impacts this. So, this is not all. This is the first third. It's just inside of it. Don't mean to scare you deliberately. That's right. Okay. Special effects there. see who's paying attention this morning. Right? And the quote is from a famous Old Testament theologian. And because he writes in German, I'm going to have to read it slowly. Because German is difficult no matter what language it's translated into. Where sin is shifted so clearly and completely into the interior life of man, and where its most diverse expressions are recognized as the fruits of a single tree, it also becomes impossible to conceal any longer the compulsive character of the apostasy. Okay, as Israel gets weird on God, in the life of Jeremiah, okay, and they fall away from God, they run away from God, they wrestle away from God. That's called apostasy. The compulsive character of it. Despite all warnings, despite all the lessons of history, despite the daily experience of the destructive effect which rejection of God has on life both inwardly and outwardly, the prophets see their people continuing on the way to destruction. Before them rises the enigma of an ineradicable tendency to sin, which takes possession of men with compelling power and drives them along its own road. The Yahwist, one of the Old Testament writers, had already recognized this inner proclivity toward evil as a deep-rooted condition of man. Now the prophets point to it again and again. To Hosea, this perverted direction of the will in his people seemed an alien vital principle. A spirit of harlotry must have taken possession of them. This is not part of my people. Something's got a hold of them. Hence, despite all the unwearying faithfulness with which God pursues them, he regards their conversion as impossible, unless by that same God a miracle is wrought. Isaiah sees his countrymen tearing each other to pieces in fratricidal strife, and they seem to him men crazed in mind. Isaiah 9. But Jeremiah is the one who ponders most over the riddle of the hypnotic force with which men are attracted by evil, even though, as a result, they find themselves in the deepest distress, and indeed cannot go on living without the narcotic of sinful pleasure. He compares the enslaving power, which leaves his people no more free will, to the irresistible force of the mating drive in animals in season, their zeal in safeguarding and closeting injustice to the water stored cool in the cisterns. I'm going to protect it. The evil habits which have become second nature to them and which is impervious to all exhortation to the color of the Egyptian are the markings of the leopard. Remember that? Can the leopard change his spots? Can the Ethiopian change his color? Can Glenn wear different clothes? You know the passage, right? Okay. The heart of man appears to him an impenetrable abyss full of gruesome riddles, the sight of which kills all hope. Jeremiah 17:9. For it never occurs to him to offload this sinister compulsion to some non-human power. The devil made me do it. Okay. Man deliberately hardens himself against the impulses of the good, and his enmity toward God must, as hardness of heart, call down judgment upon him. Ezekiel likewise portrays the madness of stiff-necked persistence in sin, as a result of which Israel has sunk even lower than Sodom and has become a Bet Meri, a rebellious house, which opposes a heart of stone to every appeal and exhortation of her God. This ruthless diagnosis of the sinful constitution of man, however, makes his situation hopeless. Of all the evils which oppress him, sin is now recognized as the most serious. See, the adversary is stronger here. And the breaking of its spell becomes the most important question in life. Such an assessment of the situation, moreover, disposes of the attempt of the law to create a world of righteousness and holiness. This is the Apostle Paul, all over again, over in Jeremiah. He said, this law didn't create our righteousness because guess what? It was trying to work on us. We are the problem. Indeed, the whole history of the nation showed how little the law could prevent rebellion against God, but instead inevitably exposed the real depth of hostility to God. The only course now left open was to turn one's eyes to the eschatological, the future, new creation of God's people, which would be able to heal the irremediable rift between man and God. Okay? In other words, the only hope was newness. We had to be a new people. We had to have new hearts. God had to do something different because we weren't going to make the cut because of who we were. And so Israel, by the time we got to the close of the prophets, they catch on. They realize that this is the problem is us and not just the circumstances we find ourselves in. Circumstances. Okay? 11. Economic redemption would have actually resulted in social equality. In other words, you would have no social classes, per se, within Israel if this all worked. You know, every time I got in trouble and I became an indentured servant, if my brother Bill, you know, it depends on how many times before he ran out of money doing this for me. But, you know, if he bought me out and I'm free again and I go back home, everything stays in balance. Now, he's going to have more money than I, or me more than him, so it's not going to be full economic parity. But social parity, I could vote, I carried as much weight with the elders, etc. In other words, that was where we were trying to get here. God was trying to build this community thing. And redemption had a very much, one of its main motifs was to do this, was to build community and social equality there. And 12, the final one, is that redemption involves some very beautiful concepts. One was freedom. Remember, see, this is the one that strikes us so close to home in 20th century Western civilization, where we are captive to so many things in life. So many things that we are enslaved to on a daily basis, some by choice, some by circumstances. You could go through what you can do as a good exercise is go through the various what they call sin lists of the New Testament. Paul's got like 6 to 8 lists where he gets on his high horse about what the people are doing around him, and he talks and then he'll go through all these horrible things that they do, and then he'll end up and say, and such were we. We were that too, and we're that now, and you know, but we're not going to be that always. We're not going to be that always. But he goes to these, and what you can do is go through this thing and ask yourself the question. It's a self-review. Am I enslaved to X? To what extent does this dominate my life? You pick it. Am I a slave to arrogance? And see, one of the things we'll see when we get to the New Testament is that the foes get tougher and that the masters now become deceitful. They trick you into believing you're free. They trick you into believing you're doing okay. They trick you into believing you're happy. You long to go back to the days of destruction and misery in your lives, right? And so there's that deceitful content. And so when we say, am I a slave to pride? Am I a slave to arrogance? Am I a slave to apathy? Am I a slave to cold-heartedness? These are not things you think you could be slaves to. Who would dare say such a thing? Being a slave to arrogance. Don't talk to me that way. You know, there's a level of deceit. I remember a precious friend of mine came to me. We were taking, we were in seminary, and we were taking these psychological profile tests. And one of them came in to me and with an honest question said, I'm having trouble with this one. Am I indecisive? And you couldn't laugh for an hour, you know, without just crushing this person's heart, you know. But when they said, am I indecisive? I gave the answer to this question. And see, there's a level of lack of insight about a question like that that deceitful masters do for us. But freedom is something that we long for. And freedom is part of what redemption is about. And we'll see this in spades when we get to the New Testament. The glorious freedom is one of those big things that God's after. One of these big things that God's after in our life. So redemption's got these beautiful concepts of freedom. It's got the beautiful concept of a rescuer who cares for you and takes the initiative in coming to free you. Because guess who doesn't get to go home and ask Bill to come rescue me? Right? I'm busy. I'm working. Okay? And but they have to take the initiative. They have to think warmly enough about me, make a few jokes about me, and then come bail me out. It has that notion, when you're part of the redeemed, you know that on the opposite end of that one, there's a redeemer. Somebody bigger than you, more powerful than you, and better managed than you, okay, and that cares enough to take the initiative to come get you. Okay? And finally, coming home to where you belong. The economic scenario where I got to return home. I can sit in my big green easy chair again. Or being displaced from Egypt and go home where my patriarchal fathers are buried, where these land where our memories and our stories are about, going home. There's a beauty of returning to where you belong. that beauty of belonging in the universe with God, being belonging in the family of God and people that care. See, these are the elements of redemption that are so beautiful. And that's part of why it's sad that the word is not used very much, because this is something our hearts would kill for. We look for this freedom in our daily lives, our freedom from habits, from attitudes, and that in our more honest moments we say, I don't like being that. I don't like thinking that. I don't like responding that way. I don't like not responding that way, in case of apathy or indifference. Right? So there's some beautiful things in redemption. And just one transitional statement before we close here. As we move to the New Testament, there are going to be a couple of major changes to this background. Some major changes that won't be a linear progression, if you will, or curve of this thing going. And a couple of the ones, I'm just going to mention three for you to think about as we, you know, over the holidays. I've already mentioned the thing about the masters become deceitful. That the things that we are bondage to are things that do not reveal themselves. Okay? That you have to get insight. Somebody has to come up to you and say, you need help here, Glenn. Okay? Somebody that loves and cares and said, I'm willing to help you. Okay? I'm willing to help you. So we have deceitful masters. The element of substitution, which we saw about the money taking the place, you know, of the labor, that's going to come completely. Every one of these motifs that we will study about the cross will have a common intersection point of substitution, that somebody has to take the place. Somebody's got to go in there and bear the consequences so you get off. Every one of them. Reconciliation, we saw in sacrifice. Redemption, it's going to be even stronger because the dominant model in the New Testament is of a prisoner of war slave. And it's really, it's not like, you know, me being under another Israelite that's under the law, that he can't abuse me or he gets busted. See, no holds barred when we get to the New Testament, to some of the levels of captivity that go on there. And then the final one that's different, major difference, is that the Redeemer comes for us in the New Testament when we are enemies. When we are enemies. We have nothing to do. We could care less. We are apathetic about getting to know God. We'll give it lip service. We'll put it in a box. Are we just outright hostile to having a warm relationship with God, because that's going to sort of force us to have warm relationships with other people? We may not be there in our personal lives either. But we're going to see some major, major deals for, you know, in the New Testament where it says, you know, even while we were enemies, when we were alienated, you know, even then His Son came to, as the kinsman redeemer for us. And there's enough love in the Old Testament to fall in love with this God from this notion of redemption. But boy, when you take that to the cross, you know, who can stand before that kind of love? You know, I can sit there and, you know, I can harden up and I can last maybe 20 minutes. On a good day where I've got lots of sleep, I can fight God for maybe 20 minutes before that love. But then sure as the world, He'll pop some little good blessing on me, some little thought, some little kind word, some little email from somebody. And Glenn's got to give in. And I won't be able to fight back again for a couple of weeks like that. Until I forget how good it is in the land, and I get fat, dumb, and happy again. Right? And He'll shake something and says, okay, time for another little redemption. okay. Many are my foes about me, oh God. Where did they come from? They just popped up. I should have started my stress medication 3 days ago. Right. So, this is the conclusion of the Old Testament background about redemption. It is revealed a rescuer that comes for us in love, that bears the cost, that pursues us, that sees it to its end and its conclusion as a revelation of the heart of God. When we get back together again the first part of next year, we will see this love and this care has a face on it. It has a face on it. And we see it do things that perhaps we wouldn't think of in the Old Testament. Washing our feet. The lowest job of a servant in the New Testament. We would not expect this of the God of glory. The God of glory and sovereign love. Let's close in a word of prayer. God, we can't stand before this love. Your love is just erosive, and we need that to erode our hearts and our obstacles. We just need you to wash away the things that stop us from just seeking you out and responding to you and wanting to get to know you and see what you have for us and to understand about ourselves what you can teach us. We just ask that as we go through this holiday season, we reflect upon these this Christmas thing, that you would have us always come back to this gift thing, have us always come back to the one who was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor, that through his poverty we might become rich. Fill us our hearts with a richness of life, a richness of this transformation. Redeem our hearts, rescue our hearts from the various things that pull on us, entice us and hold us down from enjoying and as one person said, from dancing on the water. Help us dance on the water, not just walk, but dance on the water in faith before our God. So help us as we go through this, and help us to remember you through this season, and bring us back safely together again as we can again, once again, circle around the cross and look up into the wonders of the love that came from those wounds. We ask this for your Son's sake. May we love him more. May we share him with others. And may his name be honored and the work he done honored. Amen.